The CKM syndrome is an opportunity, and an opportunity for nephrologists to be at the center of this important syndrome.
You know what? I'm going to implement this in my health system. I'm going to try to improve the health of my patients through what's in these guidances.
The number one cause of death, of course, is cardiovascular disease, and even more so for kidney patients.
Welcome to the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Matthew Sparks, and today we have another issue of the ASN Kidney Health Guidance, this one on cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome, or CKM syndrome. We have two authors of that document. We have Dr. Nisha Bansal from the University of Washington and Dr. Alex Chang from Geisinger. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you, Matt. It's really terrific to be here with you all. My name is Nisha Bansal. I'm a nephrologist at the University of Washington and was pleased to co-chair this kidney health guidance with Alex.
This is Alex Chang. I'm a nephrologist at Geisinger Health and wonderful to be here.
We've had several of these, the ASN kidney health guidance. So I think we'll just start there and talk about what a guidance is versus a guideline.
A guidance is exactly what it sounds like. We are providing guidance based on expert opinion that have been convened in this topic area to help guide the nephrology clinician on how to care for patients who have kidney disease. We do make the distinction that this is not a guideline in which we do not grade level of evidence or provide recommendations. Again, this is based on expert opinion and not recommendation based. But we hope that the guidance is still of use for the practicing nephrologist to take care of their patients.
I really like the guidances. At first, I was trying to scratch my head about what exactly is this? How is it going to be useful? And how I've seen this is that individuals are, on the community level, are taking these guidances and looking at them like a menu of items to say, you know what, I'm going to implement this in my health system. I'm going to try to improve the health of my patients through what's in these guidances. And sometimes a guideline can be just a little bit too strict about what they have to report. And this has some freedom to have a little bit more of a nuanced approach to it. So I think they've been very helpful. And I think this one in particular is challenging because the actual guideline of the cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome is quite robust. So maybe we can just start with what exactly is the cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome?
I totally agree that I think these guidances, we hope that they're very useful. I had the opportunity to participate on another one on obesity. And I think that gray area where there is emerging evidence is hopefully where we can provide the greatest benefit. You know, for this one, this is based off of, and as well as ASN endorsed CKM, cardio-kidney metabolic syndrome guideline. And the idea here was that everyone's read these guidelines. They're wonderful. They're well-resourced, well-described, and have all the evidence laid out. But oftentimes, you have to kind of skip some of the finer details or those gray areas where we don't have as much evidence. So the idea here was to try to understand what in this guideline could we take out and make it as useful as possible to anybody that practices in the field of nephrology. So really thinking about how this is applied to a nephrologist in terms of assessing CKM, what is CKM, how do we diagnose different elements of it, what are some screening tests for cardiovascular disease that we should be considering, how do we treat and prevent kidney, but also cardiovascular conditions, since now we have all of these therapies that have overlapping benefits, and then what are some of those special considerations where we have populations that we see every day, but there is not necessarily that strong evidence base for, but some emerging data. So that's really kind of the key to this. And we're hoping that all of the materials that are this great group of nephrologists and multidisciplinary group put together can really help the practicing clinician to just look at one document, get as much out of it as possible, and then hopefully do some more reading of their own, but get some quick ideas about everything.
Let's talk about CKM. As I mentioned, I always like to call it KCM as a kidney first. But what is exactly the cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome, Nisha?
Great question. So the cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome is the recognition that these three disease processes coexist. they coexist, they have shared pathways biologically that tie them together, and that because of the shared biology, we've actually seen a convergence of therapeutics as well, which is really exciting. And therefore, the care of these patients requires a more holistic and comprehensive interdisciplinary approach to really diagnose, treat, and implement therapies to improve outcomes in patients who have these concomitant disease processes. And I do understand your desire to put the K first as a nephrologist. That is certainly our desire as well. But I always joke around that the K in the kidney, then the CKM is in the middle, meaning it's the most important. It's holding together the other parts of the syndrome. So I don't think our organ is forgotten or lost here, but in fact highlighted. And I will make the point that for the practicing nephrologist, certainly does not feel new in some ways, that we understand that metabolic disease and cardiovascular disease frequently coexist in our patients who have kidney disease. And that is true. And I don't think the syndrome per se, the concepts is necessarily new, but I think this is a real opportunity for nephrology to, one, highlight the importance of kidney disease in these interdisciplinary spaces, and to work collaboratively with our colleagues across different specialties to, again, improve diagnosis and treatment of kidney disease.
One of the key tenets to this is the pharmacologic agents that we currently love and really grateful that we have compared to, let's say, 10, 15 years ago. Alex, can you talk a little bit about the framework for how we implement this kidney GDMT that we're seeing now?
Yeah, so I think a lot of this is not necessarily new to your listeners, but the indications, the evidence base for various new therapies is growing every month, really. And so when we were thinking about this, clearly there's our classic RAS inhibitors that have been around forever, which form kind of the foundation, but synthesizing all the evidence, and I know others have been advocating this as well, it really feels like SGLT2 inhibitors are forming that foundation alongside RAS inhibitors. So that's, I think for myself, that still is a little bit of a shift into practice that I've been trying to adopt more and more every day, and I think everyone is. But considering them together, especially now that you're talking about having a generic medication for SGLT2 inhibitors available that's super cheap. And
love that.
Oftentimes, the side effects are less than the RAS inhibitors. So that's the foundation. And then all the evidence is accumulating for other things like GLP-1 receptor agonists and based therapies, as there's multiple that are coming together. Right now, it's a clear indication for diabetic kidney disease with proteinuria. There's a lot of patients who have obesity and sleep apnea and MASH and other conditions where there are side benefits of GLP-1s, and we do know that they reduce proteinuria. Given all of that, I think people should be considering these therapies at an earlier stage than they might consider. And I think a lot of nephrologists prescribe SGLT2 inhibitors now, but they may not have initially because they thought they were diabetes medications. I think GLP-1s, we're just going to need to start getting more comfortable with either prescribing or figuring out ways to get patients the medications, having the patient follow up with their primary care doctor in 6 months to address something that you recommend in your note. It's not really optimal. So if we can find ways to kind of address these things quicker, I think that's really important. I'm going to pause there for a second to let...
We're in a really unique time in nephrology where we have this really large, exciting menu of therapeutic options. Alex has mentioned thinking about RAS inhibition as well as SGLT2s as our foundational therapies. And then it really becomes individualized of how you add on these other therapies. He's mentioned GLP-1s, there's MRAs, there's others that are out there that are coming out. So how do you think about that? And we spent a lot of time considering this as well in our as we were putting together this document. I think it needs to be individualized for the patient in terms of what combination of therapies works best for them in terms of their disease management and how to layer on those therapies. We mentioned two different approaches in the document itself, one in which we do what's called rapid titration, in which you start multiple therapies at very low doses at the same time and then titrate up doses, versus sequential titration, in which you start with one or two therapies, and then when patients are tolerating those at maximum tolerated doses, you then add on subsequent therapies. And there's pros and cons for either of those approaches, and I think they really need to be individualized. But I think a big take-home point is we should be motivated to get our patients on these therapies in whichever ways works for them, and try to avoid inertia in terms of starting and continuing these therapies.
One of the big tenets of this syndrome is a multidisciplinary approach, and I wanted to hear about how the group tackled that issue.
We wanted to make sure that we had good representation. So we have nephrologists and we have transplant representation, and also have advanced practitioner representation, pharmacy, also endocrinology involved in this. So I think, you know, really the bottom line I think that everybody took away from this is that we need to figure out how to work as a team, because everyone's practices are different. It's hard to come up with some super algorithm that covers implementation for every single health system or setting, private practice, academic setting. So, you know, we decided that, you know, we really have to focus on what are these elements that we could help try to formulate together in this document. Clearly, you have cardiovascular conditions, you got kidney conditions, you have primary care, of course, owns, or not really owns, but they're taking care of all of these patients. And then some of them we're interacting with and some of them we're not, vice versa for, you know, cardiology, endocrinology. But I think this is an opportunity for nephrology to try to become more integrated into health systems and take a lead in a lot of these conditions, as all across the CKM stage, these, you know, these patients come across our clinics, whether it's kidney disease or heart failure or diastolic or systolic. All these things come across our table, and we have to try to figure out how to put things together. I wish there was a more succinct answer, but really, I think the framework is useful in that it's bringing those conversations together. So now you have cardiologists who are talking about albuminuria screening, which I just saw that on LinkedIn the other day. I'm like, this is crazy. They're stealing my posts. This is awesome too, you know? Yeah, because sometimes I've had our cardiology department about, oh, how can we improve albuminuria screening? You start seeing some of that, and there's some of that you could call it scope creep, but to us, I think it should be something that we should celebrate. And then it also offers us the opportunity to rethink how we're taking care of patients systematically, you know, which patients need care from nephrology, which patients can we help provide better guidance for primary care to, you know, they don't need to wait for nephrology to prescribe an SGLT2 inhibitor. How can we work together with the common goal, knowing that these conditions are all interrelated?
One of the earlier discussions in the guidance was about risk prediction. And I think most nephrologists are familiar with KFRE and we're using it regularly, but a new kid on the block is the PREVENT score. So maybe you can talk a little bit about how do we use these risk equations in our care for patients.
I think when, as a nephrologist, we're really focused on, understandably and importantly so, focusing on preventing progression of kidney disease and use KFRE. Part of the guidance, we do highlight the PREVENT score. For those who don't know, the PREVENT score is a risk score that was recently developed and validated, which predicts 10 and 30 year risk of cardiovascular disease. It has different iterations of the equation, but it can predict all different types of cardiovascular disease, for example, heart failure or coronary heart disease, which are the two most types of cardiovascular disease we see in our patients. And what's exciting about the PREVENT score is for the first time, it's a score that actually includes measures of kidney function, namely eGFR and urine ACR. I think there's a real opportunity to actually accurately risk stratify our patients in terms of cardiovascular risk with this new score. And I can tell you what I've been doing in my practice since the PREVENT score came out is actually when I see a patient, I plug in their data into both the KFRE and the PREVENT score. So I can see both their risk of kidney disease progression as well as cardiovascular disease side by side. And I think that's, again, it's sort of part of the tenets of the CKM syndrome is thinking more holistically about patient outcomes and not being just one organ specific. And I think it's a really nice way to frame importance of therapies to patients when they see both their cardiovascular risk and their kidney risk. And if you're trying to counsel them on adherence to medications or starting medications, you can really drive home the point about how we can treat multiple disease processes and minimize risk for different diseases with single therapeutics.
I think the PREVENT is a great example of actually multidisciplinary collaboration too, because some people may not know this, but the CKD Prognosis Consortium, led by Morgan Granz and Joe Koresh, had a heavy role in helping develop this model and making sure that they incorporate the kidney function measures. So I think that's a great way that it really brings to light the kidney cardiovascular connection. And I started with kidney that time, Matt. But yeah, so I think it's a great opportunity. And sometimes the patients may respond better to talking about their heart health or their kidney health. It's interesting, when I was on a recent study meeting, the patient reported outcome that was most important to patients was actually dialysis. They rated that as the worst possible patient-reported outcome that they would face. And then cardiovascular was below that. But again, these things lined up side by side. It's huge, I think.
When you think about cardiovascular disease as a nephrologist, the next thing you think about is lipids and cholesterol. How should we as nephrology right now be thinking about that in our patients?
Well, the number one cause of death, of course, is cardiovascular disease, and even more so for kidney patients. What we're calling CKM syndrome, we've recognized that as nephrologists for many years. You might remember the article by Foley from the USRDS talking about the hugely higher risk of cardiovascular disease in patients on dialysis compared to the general population. So this is something that we know is really important for our patients. And we've had in our guidelines that we should be prescribing statins for adults above 50 with chronic kidney disease for many years, but we know that there is a lot of patients that are not on statins. So I think this is a good reminder that we need to consider the lipid as part of our care. There are specific guidelines from AHA, ACC about lipid management, with some mention about kidney disease, but I think this is something that we're going to, as a community, need to readdress and focus on with all the new data coming out. But, you know, the bottom line is, in the greater community, they're shooting for lower LDL targets, and there's more and more evidence for that, maybe not necessarily strictly in chronic kidney disease. And there's these new agents that are being used in our patients and probably are beneficial. But that's about all I'll say about the lipid guidelines. I think it's something that we need to take an active role in.
One other point about the lipids is that I think there are some whole gaps in knowledge that, again, as Alex has mentioned, we need to take a lead on and research and filling those gaps. And one is application of newer therapeutic agents beyond statins. And second is lipid management in patients with advanced kidney disease or kidney failure needing dialysis. I think based on the evidence that we have right now, I think that still remains a large unknown, is if and how to manage lipids in that population.
We just saw the first oral PCSK9 inhibitor, and it's not something that I think a lot of nephrologists are comfortable prescribing, maybe not many at all, but should that be something that we need to consider in our patients if we really want to tackle cardiovascular disease? So I think we do have a lot. Looking at these guidelines, I'm thinking as a program director, to me, the biggest impact you can make in changing the course of a field is through education, and especially in nephrology training programs. Was there any thoughts about how we can improve our fellowship education in this area so that then when the fellows go out into practice, they're the leaders and ensuring that we really do push this syndrome and try to improve our patients' lives?
That's a great question. And I agree with you that the next generation of nephrologists are really going to be the true leaders in terms of implementing CKM care in our patients. I do think it requires more discussion amongst the nephrology education community of how to incorporate this into everyday nephrology training. Certainly many programs are including more interdisciplinary clinical exposures in subspecialty clinics, maybe a diabetes clinic. We have a cardiorenal clinic that at our institution in which fellows rotate through, thinking about ways that as we grow these clinical programs in CKM, I hope that the natural progression is that we incorporate trainees, not only in nephrology, but cardiology, endocrinology, general internal medicine residents into these clinical experiences. The other way that we can inspire our trainees is certainly through research as well. It's been exciting to see the explosion of research in the CKM space, very collaborative and interdisciplinary research. And I hope the trainees see this as an opportunity as well to really answer important questions that would directly affect the care of our patients.
Sometimes the patient might think they have just a regular kidney disease from diabetes or whatever, but actually they have a genetic kidney disease or they have a glomerulonephritis. And that's where the nephrologist is so important in CKM. And maybe that's why it's in the middle, because without that, you're going to miss a lot of treatable kidney diseases. I think that's where sometimes when you see it, like you have kidney disease, well, we need to figure out why. Is that something that is discussed in these guidance? And also in the guidelines, cardiologists that are screening for kidney disease now, how do we make sure that we're not missing anything?
Yes, that's so important. I think we addressed that a bit in this, in that we really need to think about the causes of the kidney disease as well, because not everything really fits perfectly into this CKM framework, right? You have patients that have non-metabolic causes of kidney disease, whether it's genetic or glomerulonephritis. So when we took a look at all those different conditions, we considered what evidence was out there. How does this relate to special disease populations in terms of other existing therapeutics? And I'm not an expert on the glomerulonephritis area, but I will say that I learned from the experience that there's certainly going to be variability in practice, but everybody seems to, in our writing committee, agreed that you should try to address the CKM risk factors, even in patients who have a glomerular disease or kidney transplant. Now, the level of evidence to support those things is quite variable, of course. So like, let's say something like IgA nephropathy, of course, there's a lot more patients who've received SGLT2 inhibitors in that condition from the other trials, whereas you take some other conditions where there is very sparse data. And even with like transplant, there are a couple of small studies and observational data for SGLT2 inhibitors. But I think there's ongoing trials and need for more evidence because there are potential risks of infection that is, you can look at some of the pilot randomized trials that seem like they're reasonably safe, but they're still pretty small studies. So yeah, it is really important because sometimes you're going to get much more benefit out of treating the IgA nephropathy with IgA nephropathy drugs, right?
You haven't missed something. You know?
Exactly.
Like they have proteinuria that maybe could be IgA nephropathy.
Exactly. I think it's a good point because sometimes we're not necessarily having the urinalyses. So, I mean, we need to make sure that, yes, we're not forgetting about the humble urinalysis and microscopy that is part of the diagnosis. So, yeah, those are just my two cents there.
That was part of the motivation of this guidance, is that I think the HA did a great job in putting together their guideline on the CKM. But when they think about CKD, they certainly don't have a nephrology perspective. CKD is CKD. For us, CKD is not a diagnosis, right? We think about what's causing it, and we think about cause and stage, which changes the way that we approach that patient. And so we tried to highlight those aspects in the guidance. And it really opened up avenues that need further investigation.
The last area I want to talk about before we have some concluding comments is the incorporation of advanced imaging for cardiovascular disease and biomarkers. It seems like that area is covered, but I'm still a little unclear about how nephrologist uses that information for their patients.
Matt, I don't think you're the only one who's unclear about how to use that, to be honest. I'm unclear as well, and I do research in this space. I think this is a complicated area. There are a lot of tools available for cardiovascular risk stratification and diagnoses, including imaging and cardiac biomarkers. And the question isn't availability, but it's interpretation. And so I think we know that these tools can be used. We know that if someone has abnormal findings on an echo, or if their BNP or troponins are elevated, that it's portends worse risk than somebody who does not have those findings or those abnormal values. Yet what the cutoffs are or what our thresholds are to rule in or rule out disease or start someone on a therapy, I think that remains an evolving area of investigation. I think we've learned that our patients often don't fall into the same diagnostic buckets as non-kidney disease patients. But I would say that I'm hoping that there's more to learn in this space with as more literature comes out that guides our therapies. And I think this is a good opportunity for nephrologists to work with cardiologists. You know, if you order a test or if you're worried about a patient, not sure how to interpret it, maybe that's a good time to refer and put your heads together with your cardiology colleague and figure out if anything further needs to be done. So I don't have an absolute answer. I think they're still important tools. We should not use them in nephrology. We shouldn't ignore them. If they're abnormal, we should think about them. But definitely requires some more nuance.
I'd love to hear about what's the future, what's the next area, what's the gaps in knowledge, what do we have to do to implement this? What are your last thoughts on this, Alex?
Yeah, well, I think the next step is really filling in those research gaps, but then probably really urgently is how do we implement better? And that's probably going to be up to every clinician out there trying to figure out through their colleagues and the systems that they work in, the clinics they work in, what's going to work the best, whether it's working with pharmacists or advanced practitioners or some way to incorporate a team-based model. I think it's going to be critical. And then on top of that, you have so many different therapies. What's the best way to actually do this? Do you need to go sequentially or can you try to take a much more aggressive approach? And how do you cycle through things quickly to get optimal outcomes up to speed as rapidly as you can?
I couldn't agree more, Alex. Thank you. We started off the conversation with this as well. I think the CKM syndrome is an opportunity, and an opportunity for nephrologists to be at the center of this important syndrome, to highlight the importance of kidney disease as a driver, as a consequence, as an important consideration in caring for a large group of patients who have this syndrome. I think it's an opportunity for us to educate each other. I think within the nephrology community, there's a lot of learning, as evidenced by even our conversation today. There's a lot that we, the three of us, don't know and are trying to learn from each other, educate our colleagues about the CKM syndrome, our trainees, and most importantly, our patients. I think understanding how kidney disease interfaces with other disease processes is a critical part of educating our patients. And so I hope this is the beginning, continue to ride the wave of really kidney innovations that we've seen in the last decade.
We want to make sure that we acknowledge all of the writing group members for many, many Zoom meetings and emails, and really want to thank Sarah Sampsell, who is the kidney health guidance guru, who really gets all of this organized. If she wasn't helping out with this would have taken another year, to be honest, and kept getting delayed by more discoveries. So we're so grateful. And then, of course, we want to thank the ASN Kidney Health Guidance Oversight Committee and all the leaders at ASN and also the Renal Research Institute, as they helped a lot with assisting with AI supported literature review.
Thank you so much to both of you, Alex and Nisha. The fantastic discussion, and very excited to have kidney in the middle of cardiovascular kidney metabolic syndrome. And now I know that the middle is the most important part, and we all should remind everyone in the health community about that. Thanks to our listeners of the ASN Kidney Translation Podcast. We hope to see you next time, and have a good night, everyone.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare professional if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.